The Football Show on Off the Ball.
Thanks to Air. With live Premier League action all this month on the Air Sport Pack.
So we're delighted to say Phil Neville is on the line. Amongst his other achievements, there are 6 Premier League titles, 3 FA Cups, a Champions League, 59 England appearances, obviously co-owner at Salford City, a BBC pundit, and coaching work with England underage sides, Valencia, Everton and Manchester United to boot. And a former teammate as well, Kevin Kilbane, which must have been quite the honour for you.
Yes, I think out of all them things you just said, I think being a teammate and playing behind Kevin at left back was probably one of the highest, I think.
Were there ever times where you thought yourself, even fleetingly, it used to be Ryan Giggs there?
Yeah, well, to be honest with you, I play. I had Giggs here, I had Jesper Blomqvist in front of me, and then I had Ronaldo for a season as well. And I went to Everton, and I started developing a bad back. I think it's because I was carrying Kevin down that left side a lot. So it was great. I was
making you look off decent. That's what it was.
Yeah,
having to track back
all the time when I lost a yard. No, he was a brilliant professional. A brilliant time for Everton when Kevin obviously qualified for the Champions League, and then I joined the year after. And we got knocked out the first round. So, no, it was a brilliant time, brilliant experience playing with Kevin.
It's come to my mind there. I remember you asked a question. We were early on the season. We'd had a shocking start to the season. I don't know how it transpired. We started the season so poorly, but I think that Champions League knockout, then we got knocked out of the Europa League. Everything happened so quickly for us. I remember we got to around about November time. You asked me the question, do you think we're going to get relegated? I was like, no, we're grand. You've gone from winning so much at United to such a low, in such a short space of time.
I never forgot that, because we'd just been knocked out the Europa League by, I think, Steaua Bucharest. Mm. And then we've gone to Arsenal on Monday night and we've got beat 3-4-0. And on the plane on the way home, I was sat with you and Leon Osman. And it was just like, it felt like a side that was going down at that time. And I remember Moisey pulling me into his office and saying, look, it will improve. But I was having such a good time. It actually didn't matter. But I just thought, is this what happens when you're in a relegation team? You just keep losing and losing and losing. But then the game after, I think we drew with Chelsea at home. And the rest was obviously a lot better.
And can you talk to us, Phil, about your decision to go to Everton? Because I did just a quick look back at your recent appearances for Manchester United. And 04-05, obviously these are not all in the league. You only 19 in the league that year, but you had 34 overall. The year before that, you had 31 in the league. You had 43 appearances overall. The year before that, 43 appearances overall. The year before that, 38 appearances overall. So over the course of seasons at Manchester United, you were racking up close to 40-odd, sometimes over 40 appearances. The decision to go to Everton can't have been easy for like a multitude of reasons, which are obvious to anyone who watched your time at United. Did Ferguson try and keep you, or what was your logic?
It wasn't an easy decision. It was just in that last season, the boss had just bought Jemba, Cleverson, David Bellion. He was trying to build a new team, and Quinton Fortune came into the squad. And my games, and I was missing out on games for people like Jemba to play and Cleverson to play and Quinton Fortune to play. And these were good players, but I just thought that the writing was a little bit on the wall. And I got to the point where it was just, at the time, I thought, I need to be playing every week here, or at least have the opportunity to play every week. It looked like he was building a new team. Nicky Butt had left, David Beckham had left. So I just thought it was just the right time. And when I went to see him, he said he agreed with my decision, but he said, look, I don't want to lose you. So if you don't find the opportunity that you want, then I'm more than want you in my squad, because you're 35 to 45 game a season for me. And I know I can play and trust you. So look, it was not as if he was telling me to get out the door. He was just saying, look, it's difficult for me to keep leaving you out the side, because I like you, I rate you. And I said, and maybe now's the time to look somewhere else. And David Moyes had been speaking to my dad probably for the previous 12 months. Every time he saw him at a game, he said, look, if Phil ever becomes available. And Everton had an unbelievable season, so I just thought, it's an easy journey down the East Lancs. I didn't have to move away from home, and I was joining a club that was in the Champions League.
Do you get emotional do you when you tell Ferguson, when the magnitude of leaving Old Trafford hits you, or does it feel good?
Well, I actually went round to his house. He invited me round to his house, and I sat in his front room. It was me, my brother, and Sir Alex, and he made me a cup of tea. We spoke for probably an hour, 2 hours about my career, about the next move. Initially, I wanted to move abroad, because I didn't want to play against United. And then at the end of the conversation, he said, look, speak to your dad, go and find the club, and we'll speak later. And when I actually made the decision, Everton had just played a pre-season friendly against Udinese, and I phoned David Moyes after the game about 12:45, and I said, I want to join Everton. And he said, right, come down tomorrow, have your medical. And I remember coming off the phone, I phoned my dad, and I burst out crying because the realisation hit me then that I was leaving Manchester United. And for the next hour, I was bawling my eyes out. I woke up the next morning, went down to Everton, had my medical with Mick Rathbone, and never looked back. It was the best decision I ever made.
Right. It shows your relationship as well, though, Phil, doesn't it? You never used an agent, did you? So to have that relationship, there's not too many players that would have had that level of maturity, I suppose, to go in and speak to Alex Ferguson about it, particularly when you say you're leaving the club that you've been with since you were a baby.
Yeah. Well, to be honest with you, Kev, the day before, my dad had had a call off Steve McLaren, who's the Middlesbrough manager, and said, I want to sign Phil, and I think I can get him out. I've spoke to the boss, etc. So that set the alarm bells ringing. I went. Mm. My dad phoned the boss. He said, "Look," he said, "I don't want to sell him." He said, "But there are a few clubs interested in him." So the minute that a manager gives you that little bit of maybe and there might be an opportunity, then you think to yourself, maybe it is time. But I didn't want to get another agent involved because one, I knew that there were clubs interested in me, and I knew my worth, and my father was experienced enough because he'd worked in football for 20 years that. Actually, rather than pay an agent, I'd go in to see Bill Kenwright and David Moyes. One, did I want to join Everton? Did I like the manager? Straight away, I did. And then two, my father went down to London to see Bill Kenwright. He took my Man United contract with him. He showed him my Man United contract. He said, all he wants you to match his Man United contract. I didn't want any more because I was highly paid. And Bill Kenwright, within 10 minutes, said, yeah, we can do that. And it was signed within 10 minutes. I think Bill Kenwright and my dad was in the room for literally 15 minutes. It was the quickest contract talk that he'd ever done, Bill Kenwright. So it was pretty simple, really.
Phil, you knew and played under Alex Ferguson for a very long time.
Yeah.
You know, there's a caricature of Ferguson and for various reasons. What can you tell us about him which might surprise us, good and bad? You know, he's a complicated 3D person. He's not perfect. Yeah. What kind of fella did you find him to be?
Not really that complicated. He's actually quite a simple person. I mean, he very, maybe twice he actually raised his voice at me. He never ever gave me the hairdryer, ever. He had this unbelievable warmth about him at times. He had a sixth sense that when he could walk into a room, he could see a person to see if he was happy, sad, worried, or just okay. You know, and he'd come up to you. He had this. The best story is when you'd go and see him in his office, and he was an intimidating man to go and see in the office. And more often than not, it was probably when you either needed a day off or you needed to go and speak to him about your situation at the club. So you'd probably prep the night before about and speak to loads of people about, I'm going to go in tomorrow, I'm going to tell him that I'm not happy about keep being left out of this team. And you'd get it all rehearsed, and you'd go into his office. And he had two styles, I always thought, Sir Alex, and the one where if he got you into his office, you'd always have to sit over the desk to him face to face. But if you go into his office and ask to speak to him, he would always get out of his chair and take you over to his like Chesterfield suite, and he'd sit next to you, put his arm around you, make you feel like one of his sons. And then all of a sudden, all those aggressive thoughts that you had the night before go from your mind. He said, "Right, what do you want, son?" And you say, "Well, I'm actually not happy about my game time at the moment." He said, "Don't worry, son, you'll get your game time." And you'd say, "Oh, thanks, boss." And you'd walk straight out of the office thinking, he's just suckered me in there by his charm. And he was a wonderful, wonderful man who, like I say, very rarely, people say about the hairdryer, never once did he give me the hairdryer. Maybe once, maybe after a game when I'd played poorly. But apart from that, he was just a wonderful, wonderful man. He had a tough side. But if you worked hard for him, you had a great attitude, you did everything right all the time, he would treat you like one of his sons.
You joined the club at 14. Obviously, we know cricket was a big love of yours, and I know Kev wants to ask you about that. But say 15, 16, 17, I was reading, you know, Paul Scholes did an interview there, I was just reading it the other day, and he said the only one we felt sure was going to make it out of that group that ultimately did was Ryan Giggs.
Yeah.
What was your sense? How quick, you know, when did you realise something really special is happening?
Well, I think I never sense that I was going to make it as a Manchester United footballer until probably the day I made my debut against Wrexham in the FA Cup, and then the week after against Man City. Up until then, I thought I was a million miles away from the level that was required. And but in terms of the others, I mean, you knew straight away Ryan Giggs was going to be a superstar. You know, from the age of 13, 14, he was the standard bearer for all the young lads that brought came. He was playing with men at 18 when he was 13, 14, and actually taking the mitt out of them. So you knew he was something special. With Scholes, it was always the size that was a problem. But he didn't actually make the youth team in 92. He was not even in the squad because of his size. And then the year after, he just shot up a few inches, and then all of a sudden that toughness came through. With my brother, I mean, if you saw my brother play at 14, you would have probably thought there's no way he's going to play football in general, never mind football for Manchester United. But he had this unbelievable attitude and determination, and all he wanted to do was play football for Man United. So he fought his way to where he was. And Beckham did have the star quality. You know, he had that long 50-yard diagonal. He had the look. He had everything that you'd associate. But maybe he didn't have the toughness at the time. And then he got sent out to Preston North End. I think he played with you, Kev, didn't he?
I was youth team. But, yeah, he was there when I was in the youth team there as well. But, you know, you touched on that, though, Phil. But you were superb at 13, 14. I played against you when I was at Preston Schools, and you were playing for Manchester Schools at the time. You were one thing that stuck out in your mind, you take free kicks, you take corners, you take goal kicks. You were one of those penalties. Every set piece you used to take them. So you say there about maybe, who can tell? You've played with a catalogue of players at United that wouldn't necessarily have made it after being superstars at 13 or 14, but you had that natural ability within you, probably one of the most naturally gifted players, certainly at my age group, in England, weren't you?
Well, I think what I had that my brother didn't have is that I played for my town, my county and the country at 15 as well, and if you play for your country at 15 at Wembley, England under 15 schoolboys, then people think, oh, you're going to get a good contract. I got a good contract when I was 14, which meant that when I left school, so I was decorated as a young schoolboy. But every time I used to go to Old Trafford and I used to see all them great players, there was never a moment I thought I'm good enough to play for the first team here. And unbeknown to me, the night before I made my debut, I thought I was only in the squad to go and help Norman Davis, the kit man, pick up the boots the day after. And the boss had rung my father and said, look, get down to Old Trafford tomorrow because I'm going to give Phil his debut. And he didn't tell me that. He wanted me to obviously relax. I went to Old Trafford the next day. An hour and a half before kickoff, he named the team. And I was in it next to Pallister and Bruce and Paul Parker at right back and Ince and Keane in midfield and McClare, etc. And even then you think, oh, this is a wind-up, this is a wind-up. But you just don't believe it until it actually happens. But as a schoolboy, I was probably someone that probably did achieve everything and more than others, really.
Joel's touching the cricket, and I have heard you talking about that, albeit briefly. You did have a decision to make around about 14, 15, but did you seriously think taking up cricket, did you feel as though that you were good enough actually to go on and you were at Lancashire at the time, weren't you, and go and have a career in cricket? Did you have aspirations to do that?
Well, I was better at cricket. I was far better at cricket. I enjoyed cricket more. It was my maths teacher that made me decide between cricket and football, because I was missing a lot of school at the time for both sports. And he said, he got my father in one day and my mother, and he said, you can either miss cricket for football or for cricket. And I just played for cricket for England at Gloucester, and there was about 50 people watching. And about 3 months before that, I played at Wembley in front of 80,000 for England at football. So the decision was probably made in those 3 months that I had. But my biggest disappointment is that I wasn't allowed to continue my development as a cricketer up until the age of 16 when I left school, and I had to finish at 15. Because I'd just made my debut for Lancashire second team, which is like the reserve team, facing professional men, professional fast bowlers, and I was the youngest ever person to do that. So I was close to becoming, you know, like a professional cricketer at a level that no other schoolboy at my age was playing at. So I always thought I was closer and better at a cricketer to become a cricketer than I was a footballer. I thought football was just a pipe dream that was a million miles away. But at cricket, I actually thought I could, you know, maybe play for Lancashire at 16, 17 and play for England really young, and because I was breaking all the records at the time. So my biggest disappointment in life really was that I wasn't given the opportunity or enabled to play longer at cricket.
Your period at Manchester United was a very enjoyable one for Manchester United fans for obvious reasons. You won a lot. And for Manchester United fans here in Ireland, it was probably doubly exciting and wonderful because you had Dennis Irwin there, and then you have this immense thing of a guy from Ireland, Roy Keane, as captain of the club.
Yeah.
You were around him on a daily basis. So like you must have a real feel for the type of person he was around the ground as well as matches.
Yeah. I mean, he was the greatest captain that I ever played for. I think he was the person that I learned most from in my career in terms of standards that you've got to keep, in terms of leading a team from the front, in terms of never giving up, never letting your teammates down, standing up for your teammates when they're in trouble. I learned so much from him, and I had a great relationship with him when I was at Manchester United. I've got to say, he was a large part of that young group coming through. He helped us so much, and he sat with us, he talked to us, he joked with us. We talk about Sir Alex Ferguson not giving me any real telling off. You got telling off a fry if you drop your standards, and I didn't really appreciate probably what I learned from him until I actually joined Everton, and then you remember certain things that he used to demand from you when I became captain of Everton that I started to demand from the teammates at Everton that I thought, dear me. And you had this thing in your head is, what would Roy say now? What would Roy say now if somebody came with a cap on his head or not the right trainers on? Roy Keane had hammered us for that. Roy Keane had hammered you for doing that interview too late before a game. You know what I mean? So I learned so much from him. And as a player, I don't think people realise how good a player he was. People say he was tough, he was aggressive, he was a brilliant passer of the ball. He was as brave as a lion in terms of getting on the ball. He used to always say, I was at left back or right back, if you're having trouble and I've got men round me, just give me the ball, I'll get you out of trouble. And you could trust him with your life. And it was brilliant in the last couple of years when I stepped into midfield. I played with him and alongside him. You just felt safe with him being in your team. And I don't think I've seen anyone close to that kind of level of leadership that Roy gave that United team over a 4 or 5 year period. He was incredible, incredible footballer.
You talked there about him driving standards. I mean, I very vividly remember him pushing you on the pitch. I think it was against Sunderland.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, one, to do that publicly, like, that's really out of order. And so it's very interesting to hear you say that you don't feel...
Yeah, but he apologised for that the day after.
Did he?
I have no problem with but I said no problem with that. Obviously, it was the wrong thing to do. But the day after, straight away came up and said I was out of order.
Right.
I mean, he knew what was right and knew what was wrong. I mean, and there's times when he ruled by fear. There was times when he was a brilliant person for team spirit. I mean, people probably don't see that side to him, but he's a funny, funny person to be around. And, you know, I have to say, I say worshipped him probably is too strong a word, but he was one of my idols even when he was in our team, and he had so much respect. And you think about all the games that he drove Man United forward. And he played with injuries. He played towards the end of his career when he had a problem with his hip, and he did bat an eyelid. He played with hamstring injuries. He was fearless. And like I say, you can only learn from people like that. And there was times he got sent off, but you actually didn't mind because you know he was fighting for you, and you knew that the game after, he would be back fighting for and supporting you.
It's funny you mentioned the humour, because growing up, you know, as a big Man United fan, and would get the fanzines, and whatever tour you were on or away trip you were on, there'd be pictures of you leaving the hotel as a team or whatever. And it seemed invariably like Giggs and Butt seemed to be the messers. Keane was generally with them in all of those photos. It was like he sought out the messers and the team, which was kind of against the public image.
I mean, Butty and Giggs here are just a double act. And you know, the backseat of the bus was always Butty, Giggs and Keno. I mean, Keno was involved in everything in the team. And like I say, I know the young lads that came through, the class 92, you know, we're obviously close friends, but Roy was almost the leader of our group. He was sat with us all the time. He would laugh and joke with us. He had a brilliant, brilliant sense of humour. People have this stereotype image of Roy Keane being an angry man with an ashen face, but he's actually, once you're inside a dressing room and he's relaxed, match day he is when he gets his game head on. But during the week, there was times when he would take the mickey out of everybody. He would be in on the jokes. He'd have a caring side for the foreign players that would come in. But when it came to work, when he got his work head on, he used to drive us forward. I mean, training was harder than matches. It was harder because he was harder on us in matches. You give the ball away in a possession session, he would hammer you. If you didn't stay with your runner, if you give a goal away, he would be highly critical of you because of the standards that he required. And the thing is with people like Roy Keane is that you think to yourself sometimes, oh, just wait until he gives the ball away. He never gives the ball away. You could never actually have a goal back at him. So it was just fantastic. I loved playing with him. And he was someone that helped us with our success.
Phil, I wanted to ask you about your personal life, if you don't mind, just a little bit. Just on your daughter, Isabella. And you spoke before about Sir Alex Ferguson. You mentioned about this compassionate side that he had and how he had a side that many people didn't actually see. But when your daughter was born, she was born with cerebral palsy. And the one thing maybe that we both can relate to, we both have a daughter with special needs. How Everton as a club helped me when Elsie was born. What was it like then when you were having to go and speak to Sir Alex Ferguson after you found out about your daughter's condition?
Well, to be honest with you, we had Isabella when I was at United. My wife was in hospital for maybe 2 or 3 months, and he just said, look, I don't want to see you. You come in when you want. So he gave me carte blanche to do what I wanted. But we didn't actually find out about Isabella until a year and a half later, which was when I was at Everton. Mm. And at first, I'll be honest with you, I don't know how you was getting, but I actually kept it a secret. I didn't want people to pity me. I didn't want people to feel sorry for me. I just wanted to probably deal with it myself. And then obviously, I think David Weir was the first one that I told, because I missed a team get together because my daughter had a checkup and she had some tests to be done, and he didn't even know. So then all of a sudden, the Everton lads started to support and gather around for charity events. You know, footballers get a bad name, but whenever you ask them to do something for charity, for good causes, for friends, then I think more often than not that they help you out. And you know, like I say, I think a football dressing room can be a tough place, but almost you're in a dressing room with your brothers who can actually take your mind off it. I know that at the time at Everton, the likes of yourself and Tim Cahill, David Weir, they actually helped me deal with it by just treating me normal, by being there whenever I wanted to talk to them, or supporting me, or just being a good friend. And I think that's what sometimes you miss when you play football, to have that camaraderie with people, to take your mind off difficult times in your life. And we've both gone through it. But you just got to get on with it sometimes.
So how was that in home life then? So your wife, Julie, as well, I've seen bits of her, obviously talking recently, brilliantly actually on telly when... Isabella now is because she's a model now, isn't she? I was actually just seeing. She doesn't get a look from you, Phil. Anyway, let's just say that. but it's an amazing story. Like it certainly can relate to the things that you were both being told when Isabella was born. She might never talk. She might never walk. You know, all the negative sides of it, and it's the work that you've both done. But the one thing I want to say to you though is how stressful was that at home? How stressful was it on your home life, on your relationship, everything? Because it's very difficult in every walk of life from when you have this stress around the unknown, I suppose.
No, it is, and that's what I mean. Isabella's condition is the unknown. We don't know what's around the corner, so it's literally day to day. But I think people say to me now, Lord, what do you do away from football? Well, I think away from football, it's about caring, making sure Isabella and Harvey as well. But more Isabella is okay to do everything. You know, she's dancing tonight. You've got to make sure that she gets enough time, because she can't go in when the rest of the crowd are going, because she hasn't got that good a balance. Or, I mean, at the time, it was, football was almost a release for me, because it was probably the toughest moment of our lives. We didn't think she was going to walk. You know, she had all these apparatus down her legs to try and straighten her legs, give her legs a little bit more power. When people said your daughter's not going to walk, the only thing we had in our mind was is two things, really. And it was something both our parents said to us. And at the time, we thought they were being a bit harsh. They said, look, do not move around. Do not feel sorry for yourself. And we passed a little lady on the street one day, and my wife was a little bit upset, and this lady had heard the news, and she said, look, you got to treat your daughter as a gift from God. God gives you this gift, and you've got to do everything in your power to give this gift something special. So from that day onwards, we thought, right, we're not moping. We're not feeling sorry for ourselves. We're going to make sure we give her the best opportunity. So we totally redeveloped our house with rails everywhere at standing level for her. And, you know, about 8 months later, I came home and I came through the door and she took her first walk. And it was one of those moments that beat anything else that you can ever do in your life. And then from then on, family members wanted to carry her everywhere. We said, no, put her down, make a walk. And we've had to be tough. And the hospital appointments, the physiotherapy, the everything that we do for her can be stressful. Hospitals aren't nice places to be around, but we're just beginning to see the fruits of that toughness that we had to give her when we were younger. But in terms of stress, I'd say football was actually became easy for me because that wasn't stressful. From a sport that used to cause me all so much worry, so actually now I think it's just a game of football, and it helped my career in a way. I don't know how it was with you, Kev.
Mm. No, I totally relate to that in many ways. You just mentioned Harvey there as well. So Harvey's at Valencia, your son Harvey. Yeah. Was that in your mindset with Harvey doing so well out there to stay over there in Valencia after last season when you lost your job there as coach?
Yeah, it was because when I was at Everton, Eric Dyer came to Everton for a couple of years, and for a year it was, and to toughen up, he was at Sporting Lisbon Academy. So when I came out to Valencia, Harvey was at Man City, came up to Valencia, and the first year was really difficult for him because of the language barrier. He had to get international clearance, so he couldn't play for 2 months. So it was very stop-start. So we said, well, let's give him another year. And because he was developing so quickly in a different type of football, look, Harvey's a really good crosser of ball. They don't like him crossing it over here. They want him to dribble inside and play a little 1-2. So he was developing his game. So this year he speaks fluently Spanish. And the coaches have been fantastic with him. They really like him. They want him to stay on for another year. And, I think as a life experience, I don't think he could ask for anything. And to be fair, I think he's actually got a better chance of becoming a footballer maybe in this environment where they're putting young lads in the first team at 16, 17 anyway, where in probably the top clubs in England, you've got to wait till you're 19, 20. So it's a tremendous experience for him. And it's a different type of football. And now he can speak two languages. And it's been the best experience of our lives. And he's done brilliantly well to adapt, really.
Going back to your experience at Valencia, coaching-wise, what struck you about their approach to training day-to-day to the English approach?
I think the biggest thing is that when me and Kevin were in the academies 15, 20 years ago, that's how Spain is now. It's a throwback to 15, 20 years ago when you used to get the ball, go out on your session, they work really hard, do a possession, do some technical drills. There's no sports science. There's no gym. The kids just go out there and for 3 nights a week, they just have fun and play football and work hard. And I think Spain is 20 years behind England. England is far in advance than academies in Spain, particularly the ones outside of probably Real Madrid and Barcelona. But the emphasis here, particularly the last 2 years that I've studied academy football, is that let the kids enjoy themselves, play in a relaxed atmosphere. Coaches don't maybe interfere. They keep the parents totally out of the training sessions. Parents don't even allow to watch training. So the kids are just allowed to develop in a relaxed manner. And you just wonder whether that is quite smart. The weather plays a massive part because it's sunshine all year long near here. And the kids never want to come in. So at 8:30 when the coach says, come on, lads, let's go in, they're out there till 9:00. You can't get the balls off them. And they're just playing football and they're relaxed. Would I say that the kids out here are better than the kids in England at Harvey's age? No, the kids in England are better. But here, it doesn't seem at 15 as if it's the life, you know, it's the end of the world if they don't play football. They allow Harvey to play rugby, cricket at school, and it's just football for an hour and a half on a Monday, Tuesday and a Thursday is just part of his life.
The Neville work ethic, like you mentioned Gary's work ethic at the start of the interview, and like Gary has talked about you being stupidly early for everything and your diet's immaculate, and I think you're vegetarian now, and you follow you on Twitter, you still see you're running a lot, and you took that approach to your Spanish lesson, and you've said my strength throughout my career has been my professionalism, the fact I've done the right things 90% of the time. Do you have to resist trying to drill that into your son and let him find his own way?
No, because I think Noel's those qualities stand you in good stead, really, for whichever line of work that you go in. So I think there's a certain level of, talked about Roy Keane, a certain level of standards that he demanded. a demand from both my children, you know, and it's the basics that Sir Alex Ferguson told me. Sir Alex Ferguson hated players wearing jeans to training, you know, and it's like standards that you've got to meet. Please, thank you, work hard every single day, respect your coach. And, you know, I watch him play sometimes on a Saturday or a Tuesday night, and the only thing that I'm looking for is his attitude, is his attitude to work hard, is his attitude to be part of a team, whether that's in a school classroom, school exam, or on a football field. And, you know, he's doing really well. But he's always, I'm not pushing him. I very rarely watch him play. And if I do watch him play, I stay out of the way. His mum is probably his biggest supporter. And I just get sent pictures when he scores a goal when I'm in England doing media work with Kevin.
It does seem, though, for just about listening to that less pressurised environment, that is what's helping Spain produce better footballs probably when they get into 23-24. Maybe better is probably wrong, but certainly certainly that more technical player, I suppose you're saying with the weather helps, but that does seem to be one of the major issues, that the pressure that's on our kids at 13, 14, 15 through that system is certainly such a disadvantage when they're getting up around professional level.
Definitely. I mean, if you're in an academy in England now, if you've got been in the academy since, well, it's now, you're talking, they're starting now at 5, 6 year olds. So you're in the academy now at one of the top clubs from 6 up until the age of 16. You've virtually for 10 years been treated like a professional footballer. So by the time you get to 16, 17, you're actually, you're like a zombie. You're like robotic in terms of, you've not actually lived your teenage life. You know, you've not, like me and Kev, we didn't have to play football every night. We played other sports. I play cricket in the summer, which gives me other qualities of life. And here, what I would say is the biggest thing, I watched the under-21 game yesterday for Valencia, and under-21 are playing in sort of like the first and second division equivalent in England, and they're playing against men in a league where the under-21 football in England, I think, is an absolute nonsense. It's the most boringest, monotonous football you could see. I don't think the players are tested. And here, they're playing against men. They played against a team yesterday, which from a team close to Barcelona, just an amateur team, and they kicked absolutely lumps out of the Valencia under-21 players. And the Valencia under-21 players had to try and find a way to compete, just like me and Kev did when we played in the A and the B League and the Lancashire League against Marine, Morecambe away on a Friday night, against players that want to kick lumps out of you. But actually, it's part of you growing up, part of your toughening up process. And I just think that we do a lot of good things in England, a lot of really good things. And our levels of play from 14 up to 18 are far superior than Spain. But we're missing something. We're missing something along the way. And I definitely think it's the path from, say, the ages of 16 to 21. Our players get lost at about 17, 18. Because what they do, they play under-21 football, and then they just drift away because the challenge isn't big enough.
I saw Gary talking recently, and you know, I think he said it before, if he could relive 10 days of his life again, it would be those 10 days where you get the league against Spurs, FA Cup, and culminates in Barcelona. That period at United, like, you play 44 games across the 98-99 season. Is that unbelievably enjoyable and brilliant? Are you slightly frustrated missing out on the bigger games? Was that kind of your big issue at that in that period of your career?
No, it wasn't, because I think the biggest thing was that Sir Alex Ferguson made me feel as if I was the most important part of that squad. He used to always get me in and say, we cannot win leagues without you, and his management was fantastic. And like you said, I played 44 games in that 99 season. And look, if you ask a player to play 44 games now, they'd say, you can't play 3 games a week, we're too tired. But 44 games I played, and I didn't even play every single week. So it told you that I actually played I played in the FA Cup final, came on against Spurs. So two out of the 3 biggest games at the end of them 10 days, I actually took part in. So I was, you just became a part of a squad that was successful, and everyone played their part, and not one person thought, I'm more special than the others. I was equally as important to Alex Ferguson, say, than Peter Schmeichel in that, who was the best goalkeeper in the world at the time. So that's how he made you feel.
Does the penalty against Romania in Euro 2000 change you in any big way or have a big effect on you?
Yeah, it changed me. It made me a better player. It made me a better person. I was probably still one of the young ones at the time, a bit immature, and that took me up. It, it, it was probably the toughest period of my career, that was, because I got absolutely slaughtered by England fans, and I didn't realise until I came back for pre-season and went to Shrewsbury in a pre-season friendly, and the whole stadium was absolutely slaughtering me. So right. It made me toughen up, and it affected me probably for about 6 months, because I probably wasn't mature enough to handle it. But then after that, actually, it actually became part of my motivation to do well, and Sir Alex was pretty tough on me in them 6 months, because he saw how it was affecting me and challenged me to overcome the fears that I had, really.
Phil, do you know, you had so much success at United, yet with England, with the players that you had, it is probably perceived during that spell that you probably underachieved with the players that you had and not winning the tournament. I mean, we all know how difficult it is to play international football, so we would both know. And when you have limited success, but how difficult was it then when you look back at your career and you think to yourself, is it in your mindset? Do you have negative thoughts around the tournament football that you would have gone to with England? And particularly, you mentioned the Romania thing, but just around everything else with it, is that one of the regrets you probably look back on? Or
by far. I mean,
why do you think that you didn't have that success then? Particularly
we didn't have the success, and I think purely and simply because of the Premier League. And the fact that, I mean, I never forget going away with England, and United had big games, 99, 2000, all big games in the Champions League. And at the time, you'd probably say the league and the Champions League were actually becoming more important than playing international football. And I think now, actually, playing for your club is probably more rewarding and better than, or the standard definitely better than playing international football. And it was becoming that way. And we were fighting with Chelsea, with Arsenal. And these players were in our squad, and we created this us v them type attitude. And then you had to go away with England, and it was very difficult to break down that barrier of mixing and committing yourself to another cause. And
the Manchester United boys would have had a reputation because there were so many of you in that squad.
We were probably the problem. We were the problem because there were so many in the squad. We were probably the best team in the country at the time. And everybody hated us. Even the players in the English squad probably hated our success. So it was a difficult mix, difficult for the manager. Look, 96, we should have probably won, or at least got to the final of Euro 96. That was probably the best England team I played in. And then obviously the golden generation of Lampard, Scholes and Gerrard in Portugal 2004 when Rooney just broke through. That team definitely should have qualified for the final and beat Portugal in that quarter-final game. I was part of that. It was a squad where Lampard, Rooney, all of a sudden became world European stars. And we just underachieved. And you've got to say, the penalty shootouts, you can call them luck or bad luck. I just think you need to have a mentality to win a penalty shootout. And we just never really had that mentality to win a penalty shootout. And like I say, it's my biggest regret and my biggest disappointment that we underachieved so much, having played with so many wonderful players.
You've talked about like lots of amazing things here and high-pressure environments and personal stuff. Where in that kind of long list of things does 445 complaints to the BBC about your England-Italy commentary at the World Cup, does that bother you?
That was classic, Phil.
Like one of the reasons that it was a lack of emotion and monotone style is the official...
You're trying to be nice there.
Yeah, maybe. So does that really bother you when that all that kicks off?
Well, there was 11 million people watching and only 440 complained. I actually saw that as a positive, really. Do you know what I mean? I'm one of them. No, honestly, it was an eye-opener to the profession that I was going in. It was actually the biggest kick up the backside I ever had, because it was like, hang on a minute, you've had a great career, but now... you've actually got to work just as hard at your second career, which was going into the media. And it was the best thing that ever happened to me, because all of a sudden, people obviously took a big interest in everything that I did in the media. Then I got a bit of stick. But sometimes in the media, actually, stick actually helps you get followers, get attention, get work. And people, if they're not talking about you, don't care about you. So I actually took it as a positive.
And do you feel you're much, much better now and you've learned a ton? Or where are you?
I've never listened back to that commentary. I've always been a little bit too scared to. But I get told I'm a little bit better on cold commentary now. Look, it's been my one actual aim since that day is actually to crack cold commentary, because it's my most favourite part of being a punditry. and I'm getting better. I can still improve, but cold commentary at the moment is becoming sort of like the everyone on Twitter just hammers anyone that does cold commentary. You can actually do a game, Bournemouth versus Swansea, and still got hammered off people for being biased, to a Man United or for saying the wrong thing. So it's become actually a poison chalice being a cold commentator, but it's something that I do want to perfect.
I've never noticed that. I don't really get too much stick myself, Phil, as it goes.
You must be good.
Phil, one last point. I just wanted to ask you about Seamus Coleman, and you've overseen his development at Everton, and you know when he's come in and his rapid rise that he's had through at Everton, and of course now the new contract is overly so. But I just wanted to ask you about Seamus and his character and how you think now he'll overcome this serious injury that he's got.
Well, I think if it had happened to anyone else, I think the career would have been over. I really do. But it's actually, in a funny way, if there's an injury ever going to happen to someone, it's probably better off happening to Seamus Coleman, because you know that he's going to come back better, stronger, fitter, and equally as good as when he left playing football. But I was devastated when it happened to him, because he was becoming, well, he was obviously captain of Republic of Ireland, but he was becoming one of the most consistent right backs in the Premier League. He was someone that was developing, maturing, becoming a leader. And I was devastated. Like everybody else that knows Seamus, I remember the kid that walked into the canteen at Finch Farm Everton, you know, in his scruffy Umbro tracksuit, to the boy that he's developed into. And, you know, he's a wonderful person, Seamus Coleman. And I think his attitude is phenomenal. And he can only come back now fitter and stronger. And he's got a challenge on his hands, because it's a big injury. But I think he's got all the ingredients and all the right attitude to come back fitter and stronger than he was before.
How quickly did you realise when he set foot, or when he started to train with you at Everton, that he was going to go on and be the player that he's become now?
Look, it's a cliche, but you say straight away. And you say straight away because the first training session he came with us, look, he was raw at the time, but he went and he did not give a damn who he was up against. He just went hell for leather, 100% into the tackle, smashing everybody, and he had no fear. And when you see somebody like that with that kind of attitude, you just got to think, this lad's got a chance. And he was a right winger at the time, and I used to play right back. And if I could have had Seamus Coleman about 8 years before, I think I'd still be playing football now, because he used to run, he used to defend for me, he used to backtrack for me. I marked Gareth Bale one game, and I got the man of the match. And how I got the man of the match, and they didn't give it to Seamus, because I never once had a 1v1, because Seamus just kept coming back, covering for me all the time. He's a brilliant, brilliant player. And I just hope that he keeps positive, which I know he will, and because he loves football, and I think this would have hurt him and hit him hard. But I think he'll come back bigger and stronger.
Phil, do you see your future in punditry or management?
Both. I think there'll be opportunities. There's so much work out there. I love coaching. I love my time in Spain. I love my time working with David Moyes at United. I love time on the grass, but I also love the life that punditry gives me. I still live in Spain at the moment, and it enables me to live in a foreign country and still work in the best league in the world, in the Premier League, for different channels. And I mean, brilliant people. And what you find in punditry is that you work with players that maybe when you played you used to hate, and now you think, actually, he's okay. You go out for a beer with him now, you know, like you know, you see him in the studios and you share time, a lot of time in the studios with people that were great footballers, and you share your experiences, and it gives you a wonderful life. And I find it really challenging, because right. I want to be good at it. I want to be good at it. I don't just want to be just average at it. So you've got to work hard at it, just like you do any other career.
You mentioned Moyes there. Like, you would have seen him, Everton, full of fire, energy. I'd be really curious in your thoughts. It seems like the Manchester United experience has sucked something out of him.
Out of David Moyes?
Yeah, just the energy.
Well, it would do.
The passion.
I think it would do. I think it would kill your confidence. And I think what's happened with David Moyes is that, one, look, I think if you asked him now, he'd probably say going to Sunderland was a bad decision, because of the squad that he inherited. I think that was the thing. He's not going to Sunderland, the club, but going to Sunderland with the squad that he inherited. It was a poor squad. And what I'm fearful now for Sunderland is that they've been relegated from the Premier League. They could easily get relegated from the Championship with that group of players that they've got. I think they're a they're bordering on being a disgraceful set of players. They really are, because of the I saw them at the weekend against Swansea, and I saw nothing. I saw no fight. I saw no attitude. And you have to work with them every single day of this season. And you think to yourself, looking back, maybe he shouldn't have took the job. That was the biggest mistake he made on this one. And will he have been affected by the Manchester United job? Yes, because he's waited all his life for that opportunity and probably got treated unfairly and wasn't given enough time. So that is understandable as well.
Yeah. Listen, you've been way too good with your time.
Thanks,
so
we
like it's
thank you.
Above and beyond. There was one tweet in saying, tell Phil he's my step over dummy idol.
Step over, that was. If anybody wants to learn the step over, they should just Google my step over, because it's just it's an exhibition of how not to do it.
What was it Roy Keane said? Cut out the crap as you jog back?
Yeah, cut out the crap. Do that again and I'll pin you up.
Thanks again for your time. It's really
thank
appreciated.
You. See you, Kev.
Thanks, Phil. Cheers.
Bye-bye.
The Football Show on Off The Ball.
Thanks to Air. With live Premier League action all this month on the Air Sport Pack.